This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Coming up on today's show, what people love about Cincinnati and a stroll through the solar system. We'll hear about the latest People's Liberty projects. But first, about 80 to 90,000 people are reported missing to the National Crime Information Center on any given day in the United States, and there are an estimated 40,000 sets of human remains that cannot be identified through conventional means held in the evidence rooms of medical examiners throughout the country. Joining us to discuss missing persons and how forensic scientists and researchers identify human remains to help bring closure to families and loved ones, our forensic anthropologist and professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, and communications and management director for the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, or NAMIS, Todd Matthews. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Todd and Beth, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here.
Todd, we've got tens of thousands of people who are missing each year, the remains of 40,000 people unidentified. This sounds like it's a really, really huge problem, and I've often heard this referred to as the silent mass disaster. And I can understand the mass disaster part. Why is it called a silent mass disaster, though?
You know, because of time and space, you know, because it's spread out across the entire United States and it spans decades of time. So literally something could happen to your neighbor and it not affect your life in any way at all.
I agree. I think there's an element when something happens all at once, like a typical mass disaster, like a hurricane or 9/11, it's all happening in real time simultaneously, but this is just a day-by-day ticking of people disappearing and remains discovered that can't be identified.
A disaster, you kind of all go through it together as a community, and often a missing person, sometimes smaller communities, but certainly not large areas.
Todd, why do people go missing?
For any number of reasons, as an adult, you have the right to choose if you want to, leave and cut ties with your family, friends, coworkers. That's certainly your right. It's a little more difficult with a missing adult because of that right, but, there's mental illness. There can be drug addiction, crime-related, abusive situations, and simply accidents.
And, of course, as you're saying, some of this can even be on purpose, which makes it even more difficult to solve the case.
Absolutely.
Are there certain groups of people, Todd, who are more at risk of going missing?
I've seen it touches every part of society. I do think people that possibly have a mental illness or sometimes elderly people, they tend to show up on the radar more often than others.
What makes these cases tough to solve? What can make these such tough cases to deal with?
The fact that they're an adult for the most part is really the toughest thing. I mean, we're getting through the privacy issues to make sure that this person should be reported missing, that the family do consider them missing, that the community and law enforcement consider them missing. So that takes a little bit of time to get past that point. There's really no certain time frame. You might see on television that there's a certain waiting period established, but there's really, when law enforcement considers this person truly missing, out of pocket, not where they should be, that's when the clock starts ticking and you really have to start gathering information on that person. We have to know who this person is and we have to know a lot about them.
And I also think that with children, there's always a much more immediate response, or at least there seems to be, whereas with adults, they're mobile, they're out, they might drive somewhere, they may go somewhere that no one realizes that they're really gone until a certain period of time has passed. And they also, as Todd alluded, have a right to go missing. They can disappear. Some may be evading the law. Some may be evading bills. Some may be homeless individuals who no one's really looking for them except maybe social services agencies. So it's difficult to know why people go missing, but some of the cases that I think are most difficult are the ones where people just feel maybe like no one cares anymore. And so they've gone missing and maybe there isn't someone looking for them necessarily. I think those are also the ones that are more likely to wind up as unidentified dead.
Yeah, you work more on that side of things with the unidentified remains.
That's right.
What are the challenges you face in that area?
I think, to me, the biggest challenge is, you know, there are in the NamUs database, and Todd can talk about this as well, there are, you know, more missing individuals than unidentified, but recent research that I've done says there are certain types of people that are more likely to be reported missing and other types of individuals that are more likely to wind up as unidentified dead. And I think that people who are homeless, runaway kids, it's not stranger danger that we have to be worried about. It's people that are on the fringes of society. I think that a lot of times the cases that I have that go chronically unidentified are just simply because no one's looking for them, or whoever, whatever family they had is either gone, or they are so estranged from them that it's no longer on their radar.
Todd, tell us about the NamUs database. How long has that been in existence, and how did that get its start?
Wow, it's went back for many years. There were several summits where people came together to talk about missing and unidentified person, the problem in the United States. In 2007, I think, is when the unidentified side of the system launched, and then shortly after, in 2009, the missing persons component. And Beth and I both worked in the working group that helped create this system and teach it to law enforcement initially. And it was in response to literally the silent mass disaster. You know, people, I think when the internet came along and people actually started talking more, we realized more that this was a bigger problem than what it is.
And now, who can create a missing persons case in NamUs, Todd?
Anybody can create a missing persons case in NamUs. Next of kin, sibling, concerned citizen, next-door neighbor, employer, anybody can actually initialize the process of creating a missing persons report. It is carefully validated, vetted with our staff to make sure that law enforcement do agree, and sometimes that takes a bit of time to make sure that that person truly is missing and should be in this system.
So there are different databases that make up NamUs? You cover different areas?
Well, we have a missing persons database, an unidentified persons database, and we have an unclaimed persons database. Sometimes we know who a person is or we make an identification, but there's no next of kin to notify. So they'll go into unclaimed database so that people can, you know, find them at some point in time.
How easy is it for people to access the NamUs database?
But it's easy as going to www.namus.gov, and you can actually look at that. You don't have to register to look through, but if you actually want to bookmark cases or get updates on specific cases, you do need to register as a user. And there's different types of user levels. You know, I think when we first told law enforcement that the public would have access to this database, you know, it was a look of shock, fear that families and the general public would be in here looking at all the data. But there are several layers of this data, you know, the access to it, the public access, which is very limited, law enforcement access, you can actually see more detailed information, and, you know, medical examiner, coroner access, where you see medical records, dental records, radiographs, fingerprints, you're actually seeing that stuff. The general public do not see that.
And I think it's really important that to point out that this database is very different from other federal databases because it is open to the public. It's accessible by the public. And one of the advantages there is that, especially in large cities, a missing persons specialist could have, you know, hundreds of cases in his or her care, a law enforcement official, and the next day there may be another one. But for a family who's missing a loved one, that's the only case they really have. And so if I'm a mom and my child is missing, if I can't sleep one night, I can get on the computer and I can look through similar cases and just feel proactive, feel like I'm doing something.
Todd, was there a particular case that drew you into this field?
Well, actually, it was the Tent Girl case. It was a body that was found by my father-in-law in 1968, 2 years before I was born. My wife moved to Tennessee from northern Kentucky, and it was about this time in 1987 they told me about the case. She was a Jane Doe wrapped in a canvas tent wrapper, so she was called the Tent Girl. And for some reason, that case fascinated me, and I felt compelled to try to identify her to give her back to her family. And after 10 years and access to the internet, ultimately I did find her family. And I was kind of surprised because initially I couldn't get anybody to have any interest in the Tent Girl case. And once she was identified, news media literally from all over the world had contacted me. So that changed everything. It was my understanding from the news media that this was the first time the internet was used in this fashion to make that type of an identification. So I didn't know that. That certainly wasn't my plan. My plan was simply to send her back to her family. And we did.
And you say it took, what, 10 years? Is that
it did. It took 10 years. And, wow. And originally there was no information superhighway. It was the highway. It was literally driving to where the body was found, to the cemetery, to libraries, universities, anywhere that somebody had some type of record, newspaper article, something that I thought would be very helpful. So it was gather, sort all this information, and ultimately I put an unidentified profile of her on the internet, and I thought somebody would come to me. But it still took having to go out there and find people and bring them to see what we had put on the internet. And if I had not have had that put together and compiled in something that I could show to the family, I'm not sure that they would have believed me. You know, she'd become an urban legend in Kentucky, and certainly not what they expected.
So, Todd, it sounds like if you're going to do this kind of work, it takes a lot of persistence and a lot of patience.
It does, and it's hard on your family. It's hard on your married life. You know, my wife certainly didn't appreciate me sitting up half the night and then trying to go to work the next day. So I call the Tent Girl years my college years because I didn't formally go to college, but I did learn enough during that period of time that the government felt that I could give some input on the creation of this database, and ultimately I co-managed the database.
How common are cases like this? Like the Tent Girl case, and I think, Beth, in your case, it's been the Buckskin Girl case.
Well, unfortunately, they're more common than people might think. The estimate is 40,000 in the U.S., as you said, and I would think that goes back mostly maybe to the 1950s or so. A few years ago, I went to the Hamilton County Coroner's Office and pulled all of the unidentified records there back to about 1970, and there were about 40 cases. Now, I found out that some of them had been resolved in other counties in the Hamilton County where the autopsy was done, just hadn't been updated, but many of them are still open. I manage 35 cases in Ohio. Some of them are cases I actually worked on. Others are cases that no one else is currently working on, or they don't have necessarily the manpower or the resources to work on it. So all of that is volunteer work that I do.
And Todd was talking about the internet and helping to solve the case of the Tent Girl. How big a tool has the internet become?
Oh, it's been a fabulous tool because now we can easily contact these agencies. And unlike the phone where you could call and an officer might not be on that particular day, you can send an email and they'll get it sooner or later. So it's made the work easier. It's also enabled us to reach multiple people simultaneously on these cases. And it still is a trail of evidence, and you still are, you know, going back in time and contacting. Maybe you know, they're pulling records out of the archives, or they're saying, well, you know, that person is no longer the coroner, but we can put you in touch with them. So it really is a form of detective work, and you're just putting parts and pieces together to try to enhance a case, bring it more data, and then to use that on the internet to broadcast, as Todd did with the Tent Girl, all the information that you have.
So forensic work is not anything like what you see on TV, is it?
Well,
no. Pretty cool, but not quite like that.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. Thanks to Denise Hurst for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss missing persons and how forensic scientists and researchers identify human remains, forensic anthropologist and professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, and communications and management director for the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, Todd Matthews. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Beth, I wanted to ask you about the Buckskin Girl case. Where does that stand at this point?
I wish I knew. I really wish I knew. I think it was a case discovered in 1981, within hours after the young woman died. She's estimated to be 18 to 26 years of age, found alongside the road in Miami County, Ohio, wearing a buckskin jacket. And she had some very unique features. Because she was deceased only a short period of time, we have a facial image of her. We have her fingerprints. We have her DNA. We have just her dental records. And then recently we added to that pollen studies of her clothing. And then just this past summer, radioisotope studies that tell us about her physical movements, her geography in the last 12 months of her life. And I think of all the cases I've ever worked, this one is the most confounding because we have absolutely every bit of scientific data we could want in an unidentified person's case, and yet we cannot get her identified. And what that says to me is that either no one is looking for her or she has no one to look for her. We thought about maybe was she not from this country, but at least for the last 12 months of her life, she was in the U.S. based on these isotope studies of her hair. But, you know, why a young woman could be like that with this distinctive clothing and not a filling in her entire mouth, a cap on a front tooth. You know, how can you have all these unique features and still not get remains identified? And, you know, if anyone was out there looking for her and put their DNA in the national database, she would be identified. So, you know, a seemingly healthy young woman disappears sometime in the early 1980s, and we can't get a handle on who she was. And that's, I think that's very troubling. You know, that's many decades long, and there comes a point where you think this just will never happen and never get an identification.
Now, USA Today did an article back in April about this case. Did that stir up a lot of public interest in this?
It did, and because NamUs is publicly accessible, we did get a significant increase in people, comparing her to different cases, especially in the Texas and Oklahoma area, which is one of the things the pollen study suggested. But I firmly believe her. If there is a missing persons case for her, it is not in NamUs. We just can't make associations. We've excluded hundreds of individuals as being her based on either dental records or based on fingerprints or DNA, but we can't find who she is to this day.
How valuable are dental records in identifying people?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of attention put on DNA evidence these days, but dental records are still commonly used as sources of identification. And I always say, you know, when law enforcement will say, well, aren't we going to do DNA testing on this? I'm like, well, that may be the gold standard, but we're not about to throw out the silver standards or the bronze standards that we've used in the past. So Todd could talk about some of the services that NamUs offers, but they have forensic odontologists that can do dental comparisons, and they're still a very helpful means of excluding or identifying individuals, and the same with fingerprints. They don't get as much attention, perhaps, as DNA technology, but they're still very valuable.
And it's cheaper and faster. In fact, you know, all of our services at NamUs, case management, DNA, fingerprint analysis, forensic odontology, it's all at no cost to the agencies. But DNA, quite frankly, it's going to take time. It's going to take, you know, weeks, maybe months, to actually wait out the process of it going through all of the testing that it has to go through. If I have a fingerprint to fingerprint or a dental record to a dental record, we could literally do it within a day. It's all a process of elimination. It really is. Sometimes I know who a person isn't long before I know who they are.
Todd, and what about the public's help? How important is it to get the public involved in solving these cases?
Well, we've literally had family members to solve their own cases because they recognized a unique tattoo. You know, case right there in Ohio where a family member in Missouri, you know, said that's my sister because I recognized the tattoo. There were reports, but they never actually reached, you know, across the state lines like they should have. And maybe we didn't know about a tattoo. So there was nothing that we could have done in certain cases. We applied every technology we possibly could to a Jane Doe. And then without that missing persons report, without that family's unique information, we wouldn't have been able to do anything with it, even quality assurance. We've had the public to actually tell us something that we didn't know about in a particular case, or bring it to our attention so that we can change everything. So I think it's really important that we're all going to the same core set of data. That way, if there is an update, it's systemic. We're able to make sure that it's revised throughout the system. There's just various levels of access.
You know, granted, the technology is important in solving these cases, Beth, but how often is it that it's a tip from a family member of the public that really leads to the answer?
Well, I think a lot of that is handled by law enforcement. That wouldn't be on my end of a case necessarily, but we have had some really startling revelations. You know, I worked on a case from the 1988 here in Cincinnati, and long after this individual was buried, we found a blood card with DNA on it in the freezer at the Hamilton County Coroner's Office, and we're able to get DNA on a case that we thought was a lost cause. So I more work at that end of the system, and we still have revelations or pieces of new data to add. I think where a family member gives a tip, that's more on the missing person side. Maybe Todd could talk to that a little bit more. I don't know.
And we do hear from families very often, and sometimes the revelation's not an immediate identification, like that's my person in the system. I was recently, well, it's been a couple of years ago, but I was working with the family of a missing adult, and we were reviewing their case file, and we've got two fingerprints. And mom says, no, there was never any fingerprints. Just that thumbprint when he applied for a job. That was a print. That was a print that we could use, you know. So we were able to say, well, that's, you know, I think families sometimes think the traditional fingerprint is like from being booked, you know, and, you know, being arrested. That's not always the case. You know, we don't know about your records if the family don't tell us about it. We don't know where you went to the dentist or how many places that you went for dental care. We won't know unless the families tell us. And so even if they don't have a moment where they make an ID or make a presumptive ID, we often get so much more information from them as a result of that conversation.
And I'd like to add, just because this is reaching the public, that anyone who knows of anybody who's missing, make sure that you get in touch with law enforcement and have them really vet the case. Because cases like the Buckskin Girl will never be solved unless someone is looking for that individual. So, you know, it works both ways. We, you know, the coroners will find remains and they will do the best they can with scientific techniques. But unless somebody's willing to report a person missing, and sometimes there's reluctance because they may not want to get involved with law enforcement, or they may think that giving their DNA could, you know, put a distant relative in jail for a crime or something like that. It's all very controlled, and this information is used in order to help identify unknown remains and to find missing persons.
And Beth, Mount St. Joseph is hosting the Tri-State Missing and Unidentified Person Awareness Day on Saturday, October 15th. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, that Todd will be there as well. That's going to be held in our Seton Center. We'll have plenty of, it's free, it's open to the public. We'll have plenty of free parking. No football game going on that day, so it'll be easy access. It'll be from 10 o'clock until 3 in the afternoon. We'll have speakers, and those are more for a PG-13 audience, because we'll have individuals come talk about cold cases that have been solved or how missing persons cases are investigated. We will also have free fingerprinting services if parents want to bring their children in and have them fingerprinted for safekeeping by a sworn law enforcement officer. They can do that and keep the prints in hand for hopefully, like an insurance policy, we never want to use it. We'll have we hope to have a canine unit. We'll have some police vehicles, things like that, and some hands-on forensic activities so people can learn a little more about forensic science.
And there's a link to more information about the event on our website, WVXU.org. So Beth and Todd, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Forensic anthropologist and professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, and communications and management director for the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, Todd Matthews. Coming up, we'll hear about the latest People's Liberty projects. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.